more messages telling me that Fergal was a wizard on the banjo. He was an All-Ireland champion on the banjo, and his mother was powerful. Whereas on the other hand, I couldn't play one single note on the cello. I didn't even have a cello. I asked my mother, could I have a cello? She said, no. It wouldn't fit in the house, she said. And she said, you're too small for the cello. Maybe, she said, when you grow up, we'll buy you a banjo. But don't bother me now. We'll talk about this some other time. Fergal. Even my own mother couldn't remember my name. I felt so ashamed. And I wasn't interested in the banjo. My heart was set on the cello. I liked the sound of the cello. It was mellow, like me. And I liked the look of it. Particularly so when the lady was playing it. It looked happy. And I wanted to be happy. I liked the way that it stood up straight with a smile on its face, with the lady holding it nicely in place, and her left hand fondling it, moving up and down it, and fingering it firmly all at the same time. And her right hand caressing it passionately, and stroking it rhythmically with serious conviction, with horse hair tied to a stick. At the age of 6, I decided I did not want to play the banjo. I didn't even want to play the cello. I wanted to be a cello. And I wanted the lady to play me. But I didn't say anything to anybody about it in case people thought that I was stupid. One day my great auntie Lena came to visit our house, and my mother warned me to keep my mouth shut. Unless I was spoken to first. And if Auntie Lily spoke to me, I was to speak up loud and clear, because Auntie Lily was a little bit deaf in her left ear. You're a fine looking fella, says she. And what's your name, says she? Fergus, I said. You're very big fella, she said. How old are you? 6, I said. You're very big for 6, she said. And tell me, says she, what would you like to be when you grow up? Fergal. I don't know what happened to me. Something snapped inside me. I didn't want to make a fuss, but when I opened my mouth, I said, my name is Fergus, Auntie Lily. Fergus. And I want to be a cello. What? You want to play the cello? No, Auntie Lily, I want to be a cello, and I want the lady to play me. What? In the Carnegie Hall, Auntie Lily, up on stage, in front of thousands of people, between the lady's legs. What? I want to stand up straight with a smile on my face and feel the lady's warm, firm ties holding me nicely in place. What? I want to be on the stage, Auntie. Not outside, I said. In the snowstorm. On the sidewalk, yeah? Busking, yeah? In the snow, yeah? With a stupid feckin' banjo, yeah? That's Fergal, Auntie. That's not me. I'm Fergus, and I'm mellow. I'm mellow like a cello. I'm a mellow little fellow, Auntie Lily. Can you hear me, Auntie Lily? I'm glad we got that sorted out. Auntie Lily passed out. My father and Uncle Jimmy had to carry her out to the car. She never came back to our house. My father took off down the pub for a jar. And when the house was nice and quiet, my mother took me to one side, and she reddened my arse. She was so angry she couldn't even speak. She didn't talk to me for 6 weeks. But when she did, she called me Fergus. And she warned everybody to get my name right. No more of that Fergal shite. Because my name is Fergus. And I'm mellow. I'm mellow like a cello. I'm a mellow little fella. And my name is Fergus. I'm glad we got that sorted out. Thank you. Film and television adaptations of Wuthering Heights. My favourite is the one made in 1939 in black and white, starring a youthful Laurence Olivier. And I've written this poem as a homage to Emily Brontë, and I call it Wuthering Heights, comma. The black and white abridged Reader's Digest audio version, comma. For people who are too busy or too lazy to bother their asses reading books, in brackets, delivered in a dodgy Cork accent for no other reason than my wife suggested it, close the brackets. Heathcliff, Cashay. Oh, Heathcliff, oh, Cashay. Out here on the moor, you and me together forever on the moor. I don't care if you have poor raggedy trousers. Out here on the moor, you're my lord, Heathcliff. Oh, Cashay. You're my queen, so I am. Heathcliff? Do you hear me? There's no fear of me when I'm out here on the moor with you, Heathcliff. I can see so clearly. I can see who I am. I am Cashay. I am free. I am me. Heathcliff, you and me, we could be tree the dumb and tree the deal. We wanted to be. Do you hear me, Heathcliff? It's our destiny. Do you follow me, Heathcliff? Cashay, I was right there with you, girl, the whole way. Up until you came out with the tree the twins. What the hell is that all about? Listen to me, Heathcliff, listen to me. I've just had an epiphany, boy. I am Heathcliff. Heathcliff? What? Cathy, have you been eating the mushrooms out from the moor again? Actually, Heathcliff, I did have a small mushroom on the family breakfast just so, Cathy, what did I tell you? I could never be with a gal that had fancy mushroom omelets for the breakfast. Ah, Heathcliff, enough with the fancy mushroom omelets already, will ya? Listen to me, this is important, boy. I am Heathcliff. Heathcliff? Cathy? There's only two of us out here on the moor. One of us is Heathcliff and the other one is Cathy. And from where I stand, Cathy, you look like Cathy. Cathy? You're wearing a dress. And you have two milk white breasts, and Cathy, if you don't mind me saying so, what you have there is a magnificent pair of only to die for fantastic tits. Do you really like them, Heathcliff? Chalk it down, Cathy. And Cathy, you have long flowing hair with heather sticking out of it, and Cathy, you have soft hands. Whereas on the other hand, I look like Lance, did ya? Yeah? Well, he was young and dashing, right? Like, I don't know where he's dashing off in such a hurry, but it looks like he could give Usain Bolt a run for his money, right? And, Cathy, look at me. I'm the one wearing the poor raggedy trousers, see? And, Cathy, the last time I looked inside these trousers, I didn't look like a Cathy, Cathy. I looked like a Heathcliff, Cathy. Have a quick squint yourself if you're not convinced. And, Cathy, and this is the clincher, Cathy, and I have dirty hands. Ah, Heathcliff, what do you have to have dirty hands for, boy? Don't you know I could never degrade myself to marry a fellow with dirty hands? Ah, Cathy, you're an awful snob, do you know that? You are just begging for a smack in the god, do you know that, eh, Heathcliff? Why can't we just run away together? Because, Cathy, it is like this, girl. You run like a girl. And I look like Lance Lydia. And he runs like Usain Bolt. So what, Heathcliff? So you wouldn't be able to keep up with me, Cathy? That's what I hate, Cliff. Why do you have to wind me up? Because, Cathy, you remind me of a clock. A clock wearing a dress. A clock with two milk white breasts. A clock, Cathy, if you don't mind me saying so, with a pair, a serious pair of all these to die for fantastic tits. They are nice, aren't they, Heathcliff? Go ahead, you may squeeze them once or twice if you like. What I would like, Cathy, is to squeeze your head in a vice And I will, if you all shut your mouth up and stop interrupting me. Now I know what I'm talking about. I forgot. You were comparing me to a clock. That's right, Kathy. You remind me of a clock with long flowing hair with heather sticking out of it. And, Kathy, and this is the clincher, Kathy. You remind me of a clock with soft hands. I hate you. What sort of a clock has soft hands? A Salvador Dali clock, Kathy. That's what I hate. Hey, why do you have to go all surreal on me? Me, surreal? Ha! That's rich coming from you, Kathy. You're the one with the mushroom dependency. You're the one who came out with Tweedledum and Tweedledee. You're the one who came up with I am Heathcliff, Heathcliff, existential bullshit theory, Kathy. You're the one so far up your yang ye with gambiosity you wouldn't recognise reality, even if it jumped up and down in front ya. Don't know what to see. You're the one with the mental problems, Kathy, not me. Heathcliff, what is it now, Kathy? I wasn't talking to you, I was talking to myself. Jesus Christ almighty, Kathy Elshaw, you are this closet to kick up the hole, so you're Heathcliff. Who are you talking to now, Kathy? Are you talking to me? Are you talking to me, Kathy? Listen to me, Kathy. I have a better idea. Why don't you run away? Yourself. No, Heathcliff. No, Heathcliff. You run away and bring the world back to me. Why bring the world back to you? That's your plan, is it, Kathy? How am I supposed to carry out this grand plan, Kathy? Pick up the world in my bare hands. Who do you think I am, Kathy? Charles Atlas? Superman? You think I'm Superman, Kathy? Is that who you think I am? Listen, Kathy, look at me down with that. Can you see me wearing electric blue finger-hugging tights? Can you, Kathy? Can you see me wearing red Speedo-type underpants on top of blue tights? Can you, Kathy? When, Kathy, when was the last time you saw Superman wearing poor raggedy trousers, huh? Tell me that, Kat! Listen to me, Kathy, you need glasses, yeah? You should have gone to Specsavers when I told you to! I hate Cliff! Heathcliff, why don't you run away yourself? Run away yourself, Kathy. Listen, Kathy, I've got a better idea. You run away yourself instead, yeah? Because I need you, Kathy, like I need a hole in the head. And listen, Kathy, you can take her to die for tits with you. And, Kathy, when you get there, don't bother your ass coming back. Because I've had enough to hear with you, girl. You are one seriously on fire, backing that lighting bitch, so you're anxious. Why don't you just fake off? Fake off yourself, Kathy. Come back, Heathcliff. Come back, Kathy. In brackets. Wuthering Heights will never be the same again. The end. This next thing is called a fridge. What else can I say?
I look inside my fridge.
I see a pint bottle of Phoenix and an old Indian vindaloo with a grease-stained brown paper bag. And I see a hard-boiled egg carved up in its lock. You could say his goose was cooked, you could say he had seen better days. But either way, whatever you say, there's absolutely no way is he ever going to see salad days up close and personal with his green squeeze, Hellman's real mayonnaise. And I see an empty tub of no-no. No, it's supposed to be good for my cholesterol, but it's not much good to anybody if the tub is empty, don't you know? You see, somebody scraped the tub clean with the tip of a knife and replaced the empty tub back in the fridge. Consider, will you, for a minute, the type of person that would do such a thing. And consider next that I live alone. And finally reconsider the empty tub looking up at me, grinning at me, mocking me, having a laugh.
From the middle of my fridge.
Oh,
sad remains of a not so recently deceased gluten-free cheese sandwich. Not looking great. And I see sell-by dates, the date back before the date that predates the date that sell-by dates were even invented. And I see new life forms that are incubated in my absence sometime in the meantime since the last time I looked inside the room. Oh yeah. Now it's a dried up, shriveled, hard, flat little thing that I can see myself using as a plectrum in an emergency. But most of all, what I see is an urgent cry, indeed, screaming need to organise and launch a serious expedition which will go far deep into the back of my fridge and will seek out and find the source of the disturbing mad odour that permeates the whole of my house every time I open up. Don't love my
and they want to be groovy.
wars of English between them. So once again, oh, you don't care. We're gonna call ourselves Torres' Band. We'll be very enigmatic. We'll break them by the nuts, cutting it stop. We'll be outrageous. And we'll write our own lyrics, mostly in Icelandic, with a little bit of Latin thrown in for the crack. We'll be groundbreakers, and we'll perform wearing wet suits, with steel-tipped workers' boots, turtle vests, name of the band written on our chests. We'll be so iconic. And the girls will wear cycling shorts with terrible socks, fisherman hats, plastic masks, and sunglasses. We'll be trying out. We'll do a massive tour of Europe. And we'll bring along the Batman. I'm out too. And we'll bring along the sisters. I told you, I'm not stupid. And Lithuania, but we won't disappear. Up all on the anger, arrogant surprise, with our faces around us. We won't forget where we came from, and our humble beginning. No matter where we are, we always do our shopping. You know fair, and we record our own album on a voice recorder costing only $9.99. We'll distribute our CDs all across Europe, exclusively to Lidl, coming to a store near you. When's that for this? Next Thursday. I heard the weatherman say to expect four flock of the schnockta on the high ground, four on the low ground, and flock coming down in bucketfuls all round. Already some people are knee deep in flock. The PDs are terminally flocked, and the greens have been sucked into a hole, which is fast filling up with flock, and unless they get the flock out of the hole, and get the flock out of the hole fast, they'll stay stuck forever in the hole, they drown in the hole, they'll never get out. But we need never freak out, because we will be the finest evermore as long as we keep building hotels. We can have a couple of hundred hotels thrown up on Lofty Bob out on Kilroan before the year is out. If we put our minds to it, it'll be like the good old times. We'll bring back the Polish fellas to build the hotels for us, and their sisters can work in reception. And when we get fed up with all the fluff, we can go into any of those hotels and pretend that we're in the Bahamas. And we won't freak out when we run out of space out on Kilroan, because we'll go on building hotels up on Mars. Mars doesn't have flock. Mars is a flock-free zone. We won't even have to put rooms on the hotels up on Mars. We can throw them up for half nothing in no time. We can have a couple of thousand hotels thrown up on Mars before the year is out if we put our minds to it. It'll be like the good old times, naturally. We'll be bringing along the Polish fellas, and naturally, we'll be bringing along their sisters. And we can gather flock up in containers and bring the flock up to Mars, where we'll build flock museums for the tourists and the children who've never seen flock. Daddy, what flock? You won't even have to open your mouth to the child, grab him by the arm, drag him down the street, run into the first flock museum with you. He'll learn everything he needs to know about flock, and if he wants to know more, sends her down to his Auntie Mary, who's still living in Tipperary, the great big hotel out on Kilroban. She's getting on the fines for all her neighbours, who are all Polish. She still pretends she's in the Bahamas, but it sounds more like Gdansk. And there's a hole in the roof, and the flock is coming in, the flock inside and out, and by the time the child gets back up to Mars, he'll be able to give seminars on flock. He'll be a flock expert, ready to open up his own flock museum. And we won't freak out when we run out of space out on Mars, because there are other planets out there. I happen to know for a fact that there are no hotels built on the planet Uranus. But Uranus is looking good to me. It's a wide open opportunity for someone with a bit of flair and creativity. I believe in the right hands, given the right approach, Uranus could be a very exciting place for hotel builders. Given the fact that, like Mars, Uranus is a flock-free zone, we could have a couple of 500,000 hotels drawn up on Uranus before the year is out. If we put our minds to it, it'll be like the good old times. Of course, we'll be bringing along the Polish fellas, and they don't even have to mention it. We'll be bringing along their sisters, and we'll never have to freak out ever again, because we will be the finest evermore as long as we keep building hotels. We came down from Tipperary to be with you here tonight. By the way, you're great. You're great. Thanks for living with us. The art is brilliant. But if you ever go to Tipperary, you should go to Nina. And if you go to Nina, you should walk up the main street of Nina towards Summerhill. Keep going until you come to a door with word push written on it with indelible marker. Stand still and indulge the thrill, because you will be standing outside Norma Quinn's traditional Irish music emporium. And if you step inside, you'll know why it's the best traditional music shop in the world. Because he's got banjos, and he's got bongos, and he's got bowrons, and he's got balalaikas inlaid with genuine mother of plastic brought all the way from Belarus. They even light up in the dark all by themselves. And he's got bazookis, and he's got guitars. He's got guitars made in Taiwan, Hong Kong, Tokyo, and Toowoomba. He even has guitars made from tin cans by geriatric chimpanzees living rough on the streets of Polokwane. They are lucky to have a job to go to. And he's got boxes of strings under his counter for every string instrument under the sun. And if he didn't have the string that you were looking for your mandola, he'd go into the back of his shop where he's using only and ordinary pliers and bits and pieces of broken strings picked up from the floor. He would fashion for you the finest bronze wound beauty that you ever saw in your life. And if you wanted a ball in it, he'd put a ball in it. And if you had the misfortune to lose your temper at a session and hit a heckler over the head with your mandola, he would take your broken mandola into the back of his shop, where using only and ordinary pliers and bits and pieces of a broken Appalachian dulcimer and old hurdy-gurdy and gorilla glue, he'd repair for you your mandola and hand it back to you, looking as good as new, better in fact than the day that Joe Foley put it into your hands somewhere up in Rathfarnham. And he's got percussion instruments, beat the band, and wind instruments, new and second hand. And he's got whistles, big whistles, small whistles, long whistles, high whistles, low whistles. He even has slow whistles, especially for the slow learners and the musically retarded like me. And he's got CDs sprawled all across his wall, featuring every blessed man, woman, child that ever played a traditional note in their lives. And if he didn't have the CD that you were looking for, he'd go into the back of his shop, using all the ordinary pliers and bits and pieces of scraps of broken CDs picked up from the floor. He'd make you a shiny new copy of the greatest hits of Tom Lawlor, volumes 1 to 24, or whatever it was that you were looking for yourself. And he's got concertinas on the bottom shelf and harmonicas on the top shelf. And he's got fiddles and flutes that look so cute you'd nearly think they play tunes all by themselves. And he's got a mountain of books as big as Kilimanjaro. Books of tunes piled up on top of more books of tunes. He's got books about songs and songs about books. He's got books about songs that were turned into movies and books about songs that were turned back into books. And he's got a book that will teach you how to play the gazoo, the glockenspiel, and the didgeridoo all at the same time. And he's got a book entitled 12 Easy Steps on How to Be a Musical Legend, written by the musical legend Tom Lawlor, and it comes with a free DVD showing how to wink and smile and play killer tunes all at the same time. And if he didn't have the book that you were looking for, he'd go into the back of his shop, where using only an ordinary pliers and bits and pieces of scraps of paper picked up from the floor and an old school satchel, he would make for you a first edition leather-bound copy of Chronicles Part 2, signed by Robert Zimmerman himself, or whatever it was that you were looking for yourself. And the day that a man from the trade descriptions office came down from Dublin, he said, "Mr. McQuaid, it's come to the attention of my superiors up in Dublin that you were overheard in the back of a van talking to a man selling him a Japanese-made, handcrafted, genuine Irish, 2,000-year-old, authentic, antique, traditional Irish slide trombone." And we all know, Mr. McQuaid, that the slide trombone is not a traditional Irish instrument. Well, that's where you'll be wrong to know. My great ancestor, Gandalf Winston Boogie McQuaid, the great flying wandering trombonist, born in Catterseireen in the 1st century, was the first man to introduce the slide trombone into mainstream traditional Irish music. He was at the forefront of the whole Celtic jazz, trad, soul, fusion explosion that was sweeping the country at that time. He wrote hundreds of killer tunes, jigs, reels, and slides on the slide trombone. He even made his own slide trombones. He is known worldwide as the Stradivarius of the slide trombone. I see for the man from the trade descriptions office who have travelled all the way from Dublin, and I suppose you have documentation to prove this, Mr. McQuaid. I certainly do, said Lord. Wait there 1 minute. And he went back into the back of his shop, where using only an ordinary tires and more bits and scraps of paper picked up from the floor and the label from the inside of the broken application puzzle. And he made a document that the fellas up in Dublin would only die to have in their collection. I see, said the man from the train descriptions office, who traveled all the way from Dublin. But this document does not show me how the trombone could possibly be Japanese made and genuine Irish at the same time. Obviously, says Noel, you fellas up in Dublin know nothing about traditional music, its history and its heroes. Did you not know, said Noel, that my great ancestor, Gandalf Winston Boogie McQuaid, married a Japanese one called Yoko from Kyoto? She used to be the lead screecher with the experimental copper band. And while the great man was blindly wandering the roads up and down the country playing killer tunes on his slide trombone at sessions and gigs, Yoko took over the running of the workshop, and she had sisters over in Kyoto, and they came over to Catterseireen to join Yoko in the workshop with the making of the slide trombones. You can see where this is going, can't you? So, there's no... When I was overheard in the back of the van talking to a man from Donegal selling him a Japanese-made check, handcrafted check, genuine Irish check, 2,000-year-old check, authentic antique check, traditional Irish slide trombone check, 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 I was in no way good, bad, or indifferent in breach of the Trade Descriptions Act. In fact, I was being 100% accurate. So, said Noel, you may take that information and you may shove it politely, or whatever other way you wish to shove it, up your yin-yang, turn round, go back out that door and fuck off back to Dublin, where you came from. And you can tell your superiors that recently the readers of Roots magazine, Hot Press and Rolling Stone voted Noel McQuaid's traditional Irish music emporium to be the best traditional music shop in the world. And in conclusion, said Noel, if you ever darken my door again, I will personally drag you into the back of my shop where using all this and ordinary pliers and nothing else, I will, without mercy, without anesthetic, liberate your Leroy D in slow motion from your scrotum, and you'll never play another sweet note on your fat oak ever again. He's a tradition. Line of the street, and he would meet a queue of fellas a half mile long. and they'd be queuing up for half the night waiting for your man to come along so they could give the right ball to be called ours. And on the other side of the street was a queue a mile long. A queue of fellas called Horse. With only one ball. And they were queuing up hoping to get their balls back. And they'd be queuing up the whole night long, along with their mothers, who were sick and tired of their sons being called Horse. Their sons were sick with remorse. And they wanted their right balls back. Because they were sick and tired of having a slack back. Their mothers were threatening to go on strike and refused to iron their son's shirts. And slacked. Unless their sons got their right balls back and unless their sons went back to being called Billy and Jack. The Irish way of life, Jim, as we know it, was under serious attack. The country was split right down the middle, mother against son, son against mother. On the one side was the anti-horse faction, on the other side was the pro-horse faction. Every day of the week out in the streets there were demonstrations. Anti-horse demonstrations and pro-horse demonstrations. And the demonstrators were clashing. There was blood on the streets, with each faction baiting the living daylights out of the other faction. The whole country was calling on the government to take action. The government called in the army and the SDA. The bishops were calling on the whole country to fast and pray. The opposition were calling for a debate, but it was way too late for a debate. There was no debate on the streets. They were baiting each other on the streets. There was blood on the streets. The primate of all Ireland was calling for reconciliation. And mothers of sons who gave their right balls to call hearts were calling for their sons' right balls reinstallation. The Church of the Latter-day Saints were calling for restraint, but there was faint hope of restraint on the streets. The Chief Rabbi of Ireland was calling on everybody to exercise forgiveness. And the anti-Semitics were calling on the Chief Rabbi to mind his own feckin' business. The moderator of the Church of Ireland was calling for moderation. And Richard Harris, not surprisingly, said, "I don't believe in moderation." The Pioneer Association were calling for total abstinence. And Richard Harris, not surprisingly, said, "You must be fucking joking. I don't believe in abstinence, total or otherwise." It came as a big surprise when the central bank called for devaluation of the pound, but no surprise when Richard Harris called for another round. The media called for a mediator to be installed. But when he was installed, the media were appalled to find out he was called horse, and he had no balls at all. So they recalled their call for him to be installed, and instead they called for him to be uninstalled unless he grew a pair of balls and went back to being called Jack. The Pope was calling the kettle back. Ian Paisley was calling the Pope an antichrist. Just for the crack. And mothers of sons with only one ball were calling on the fellow who collected their son's balls to give their son's balls back. John and Yoko were calling on everybody to give peace a chance. And Bianca Jagger called on Mick for pity's sake to stick to the song and the dance and for once in his life to pull up his pants. Nelson Eddy called Jeanette MacDonald Rose Marie. And the Blue Army called on the whole country to say 5 decades of the Rosary. The Dalai Lama, God bless him, called for peace. And calm. Father Ratzinger, I'm not making this up. Father Ratzinger, I couldn't make this up, I'm not that good. Father Ratzinger called Buddhism a form of autoerotic self-harm. And Robert Zimmerman called on everybody to work no more on Maggie's farm. The Maharishi joined with the Dalai Lama and both of them made one last desperate plea for more peace. And more calm. But there wasn't any calm out in the streets. They were baiting each other in the streets. There was blood on the streets. is a fact, and everybody wanted to get in on the act. Some fella, I don't know who, but this fella somehow, I don't know how, but anyhow, this fella decided for some reason, I don't know why, but he decided to call a spade a spade. This was obvious to most of us already, but obviously it wasn't obvious to him. Obviously he just liked spades, the obvious, so he lectured us on spades. And Richard Harris called on all the girls working in the barmaid trade up and down the country to come to his aid, and he made them promise never ever to serve him lemonade. It looked as if things couldn't get any worse when Buffy Sainte-Marie sang a little ditty calling on the whole country to agree to turn their backs on all the misery and all the pain. And Richard Harris, he was in terrible pain because some stupid fecker went and left the cake out in the rain. And Richard Harris went on through the medium of a duet song, a 6 minute long bombastic refrain in which he passionately proclaimed that he could no longer take it because it took so long to bake it. And he never had the recipe again. Oh no, the whole country was gone beluga. So, De Valera called for a truce, and Richard Harris said he didn't believe a truce would be of any use. But believe it or not, a truce was what we got. A delicate truce, a precious truce, a hanging by a thread, don't sneeze, don't breathe, don't even do nothing in case the thread might break and we lose the truce type of a truce. The whole country held its breath. The next step was going to be absolutely crucial. The government called Richard Harris and they asked Richard Harris if there was anything that Richard could do, considering that he was the fella causing all the trouble in the first place. It was his sole reason he had caused the whole hullabaloo. And what did Richard Harris do? He only went and made another movie called A Man Called Horse 2. And the whole fucking thing started up all over again. Oh,